champion of liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Now let's join Dr. Coben with Christian Worldview.
All right, good morning. This is Greg Farrier subbing for Dr. Coben, who's down in South America pushing back the frontiers of ignorance in Chile and Peru and maybe a few other places that I'm unaware of, but he should be back Monday. And I've got the show for now, and you are welcome to call in and discuss some of the things that we've been going over the week. One thing that perked my attention, I was listening to the yesterday's show on the way in, and Chuck had called in, and he had mentioned Bill Buckley came up in conversation, and I thought that this might be something interesting to discuss, get things going here. By the way, before I forget, around 8 o'clock, Dr. Stephen Yates is going to come in, a philosophy professor who is well-versed on the situation with CAFTA. So if you can get by a radio at 97.7 FM or get by your computer and listen to Dr. Yates's information that he has on CAFTA, and hopefully we'll be discussing a few other things. So stand by for Dr. Yates, who has not arrived yet, but he ought to be along shortly. Back to Bill Buckley. He's an interesting person. I wanted to make sure that I didn't even leave any false impressions of my impression of Mr. Buckley, who I can remember since I was a little kid. Of course, he's much older. I guess he's into his 80s now. But a very erudite individual, a musician, philosopher, navigator, a wordsmith, a magnificent wordsmith. He's the kind of guy that if you read his columns or listen to him, he always comes up with some kind of a new word, some whether it be long or short. He's a very interesting wordsmith, one who puts words together and uses them in most amazing ways. Mr. Buckley grew up in a wealthy family and is well educated. My brother happens to know his brother, who's in another business, and they are all rather erudite, bilingual, trilingual individuals. The interesting thing about Mr. Buckley, he was old enough to be drafted or enlisted into the Army in World War II. And he got out in 1946, and he went to Yale University, and he went there as a conservative Catholic American, and when he got out, I guess a lot of academia at the time thought that he was had pulled a fast one on them. He wrote a famous book called Of God and Man at Yale, wherein he exposed the leftist bent of the Ivy League schools. And, of course, here's this young fella right out of college, probably a little older than most because of his being a veteran of World War II, having spent some time in there. Nonetheless, a young man, but a very erudite individual even then at the time, goes out and writes a book against his professors. And as I said, exposing the leftist bent, socialist bent of the professors at in the Ivy League schools. Well, that became, in the circles of academia, I guess, in some ways, a source of bitterness, a situation wherein the right people that were ostensibly conservative, all-American type people began to say, "What in the world is happening over here?" Well, notice the time frame there. Buckley was in school right around 1950, right after World War II, not long after the Roosevelt administration and all its socialist policies. And this did not happen overnight. If you look a little further back in history, in our own American history, there was a tremendous socialist movement in the teens and 20s and 30s. And if you go back further than that, you're going to see you had Darwinism and the rise of Marxism as it began to fester and permeate American social and political society. Well, here we are at a situation where somebody, an ostensible conservative, goes out and sounds the alarm. Going back into the teens and 20s and 30s, in the church situation, you had the fundamentalist movement, which was a counter to the modernist movement, as it was known then. The modernist movement began to deny the scriptures. They didn't just all of a sudden come down and slash at the scriptures with a flaming sword and try to destroy it. What they did it all in a very subtle way. They did it in terms of the literature of the scriptures. Remember the documentary hypothesis, which, when it was first introduced, many an evangelical godly individual espoused it just because of its sheer scholarliness. So when it's like the frog in the hot water situation, a little bit here, a little bit there, and before you know it, you've lost it all, or you have a cooked frog. You take a little bit of the scripture here, a little bit of the scripture there. You say that this is not valid, that's not valid, and next thing you know, it becomes worthless to you. Well, here is the situation in the early 1900s, where you get the beginnings of the what we commonly call the fundamentalist movement, which is the movement that wanted to go back to what were commonly called the fundamentals of the faith. And not wanting to get into all an exposition of all what the fundamentals are, let's just, for now, let's say the blood, the book, and the blessed hope was sort of a catchphrase that fundamentalists used back in those times, in that you had the blood of Christ, which was the atonement for sins. The Holy Bible was an inspired book, and we had the blessed hope of the Lord returning to make all things right. Although that developed an aberration in that when the Lord returned, he didn't necessarily make all things right. You still had all these other situations to go through once the people of God were raptured out. That was one of the main tenets of fundamentalism. All fundamentalists were not of that dispensational rapture thought process. There were others as well. Other people that were into the, that were, shall we say, bumped up to the fundamentalist movement were people like B.B. Warfield or J. Gresham Machen, who did not wholeheartedly put themselves into that movement just because of some of the Arminian and dispensational matters that were propagated by the fundamentalist movement. In case some of you are interested, well, let me run this one past you. Does anybody know what fundamentalism is? What are the fundamentals? Do you know that there is a book that tells you a whole lot about it? Our engineer signaled me that we need to take a time out here for a minute, and I'll continue this as soon as we're done with our break.
If you have a question or comment for the show, please dial 864-244-8177. That's 864-244-8177. You may also dial 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. Or you may email your question or comment to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. And remember, the show is live from 7:30 in the morning until 9 in the morning Eastern Time. If you're listening at any other time you're listening to a recording, calls will only be received between 7:30 and 9 in the morning Eastern Time.
You're listening to TRN, the Tyranny Response Network. It's roughage for your brain.
Hi, this is Dr. John Coben. Is it okay for a Christian to become wealthy? Did you know that 8 out of 10 Americans will face retirement with little or no savings, even Americans who had good incomes? At Integrity Group, we are dedicated to providing personalized service, finding effective ways to protect and increase your hard-earned money. Integrity Group is an independent financial planning firm that offers a wide range of services. We specialize in finding creative, custom solutions to meet the needs of each individual. Do you have concerns about providing for your retirement? Do you want to ensure that catastrophes like disability or long-term care will not wipe out your savings? Do you need to have your assets protected from creditors? Do you want tax-advantaged growth of your savings? At Integrity Group, we recognize that time passes all too quickly. Sound financial planning is not something to be delayed. Our offices are located at 514 Pettigrew Street in downtown Greenville. Make an appointment with Integrity Group today at 864-244-6464. That's 864-244-6464.
If the state sets itself up as the supreme arbiter of human affairs, it must domesticate the individual, lest any lingering remnants of self-reliance weaken the state's authority. The state must resist the individual's effort to follow the dictates of his conscience, lest they conflict with the decrees of Caesar. In the interest of its own safety, the state must eventually deny that the individual is a person, for the individual can be a person only when he puts his obligation to God ahead of his obligation to Caesar. Reverend Edmund Oppitz, in the Libertarian Theology of Freedom, page 145. You're listening to TRN, the Tyranny Response Network, where we comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable.
All right, we're back. I was just talking in terms of the fundamentalist movement. Did you know that there is a 4 or 5 volume set out there that was published by a bunch of wealthy merchants in sympathy with the fundamentalist movement? You can buy it to this day with all kinds of articles in it. It went through various editions, but you can get out there and you can get it. In most cases, it's quite profitable to read. I commend it to your perusal. People like J. Gresham Machen and others, B.B. Warfield was passing off the scene and his influence at Princeton at this time, and Machen, who grew up in Princeton, shall we say, the great New Testament scholar and educator, he was a one who stood for Reformed, he was in the Reformed Presbyterian tradition at Princeton. He stood for the conservatism and the Reform perspective of his time in the teens and 20s and 30s. He died in 1937, if I remember right. And Dr. Machen was one of the people who had radio broadcasts, and he went around preaching and writing literature. He was one of the great defenders of the faith, and you can also get his works available now. And I see we have Dr. Yates has arrived, so we'll be getting to him momentarily. But anyway, with Dr. Machen, as I say, his works are available today. I commend them to you. He also, I think it was in 1929, testified before the Senate about not having a federal Department of Education. And he did that in 1929, and of course Jimmy Carter got it put through in the 70s. So we even had people back then that were fighting against it and realized the incursion of the socialist movement, men who wanted to control other people in and around our government. And let me fast forward from the teens and the 20s and 30s and 40s. Of course, we had that great disturbance, World War II, where much chaos in government was brought about. Then we go on to around 1950, where Bill Buckley came in, and came on the scene and wrote of God and Man in Yale, which was an early alarm, call to see that socialism was rife in academia. It was also rife and widespread in government. Roosevelt's Secretary of State was convicted. Alger Hiss was convicted as a communist spy. All these things, all these scandals were abroad, and Buckley was perhaps the first to sound the alarm to any great degree. We also, a little later on in the 60s, have one Barry Goldwater, who was supposedly an arch conservative, who ran for president on the, he was the beginning of what we might call the conservative movement, which attracted people like Ronald Reagan. It attracted other ostensibly conservative politicians and industrialists and people of that nature, which, as we see to this day, has deteriorated. Barry Goldwater started out as a conservative, as somebody who was very attractive to these people, but in later years he was selling out the farm, as Buckley would be, I guess, today one of the godfathers of the neocon movement. Well, I threw that little piece of history in there, not to disparage Bill Buckley, because you can read him profitably, but there were certain principles that he let slide, which opened the door to what we have today as our neocon movement. We have Dr. Yates has arrived. Could we take a break now? And when we get all these announcements and things before you, we'll be back to take on Dr. Yates.
If you have a question or comment for the show, please dial 864-244-8177. That's 864-244-8177. You may also dial 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. Or you may email your question or comment to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. And remember, the show is live from 7:30 in the morning until 9 in the morning Eastern Time. If you're listening at any other time, you're listening to a recording. Calls will only be received between 7:30 and 9 in the morning Eastern Time. You're listening to homeschooler-friendly TRN, the Tyranny Response Network. Hello, this is Dr. John Coben. Get a copy of Bible and Government, Public Policy from a Christian Perspective, my latest book. You can buy it online from Alertness Books. The link is at the top of policyofliberty.net. That's www.policyofliberty.net. It's only $11, and it will help you think about the Christian's relationship to public policy and the nature of the state. Be sure to get a copy today of Bible and Government, Public Policy from a Christian Perspective.
The Patriot Network is a national federation of local clubs devoted to bringing relief to the oppressed American taxpayer. It is based right here in the South Carolina Upcountry and chaired by Dr. John Coben's associate, legendary freedom warrior Robert Clarkson. Visit our website at patriotnetwork.info for full contact information, meeting times, and locations around the South and beyond. That's Patriot Network, one word, .info. There you can also sample many action reports, current and past issues of our newsletter, and mainstream news features about IRS rot, corruption, and incompetence. Find out what our decades-old organization may be able to do to put a stop to your IRS problems. PatriotNetwork.info commends Dr. John Coben on the founding of the Tyranny Response Network and his unique Christian worldview show, heard weekday mornings right here on TRN.
Music. This is Dr. John Coben. Visit policyofliberty.net. That's www.policyofliberty.net on the web. You'll find there books and articles written by Dr. John Coben, that's me, the Tyranny Response Unit, regarding things related to covenant marriage, allodial land titles, and free market economics. You'll also find there portraits of famous economists, including their biographical information and links to their famous works, as well as many, many quotations for liberty. Visit policyofliberty.net on the web today and find a wealth of information to help advancement of the truth.
There is a place for government in the affairs of men, and our Declaration of Independence tells us precisely what that is. The role of government is to protect individuals in their God-given individual rights. Freedom is the natural birthright of man, but all that government can do in behalf of freedom is to let the individual alone, and it should secure him his rights by making others let him alone. Reverend Edmund Oppitz, in The Libertarian Theology of Freedom, page 142.
Liberalism is not to be tossed lightly aside, but to be hurled with great force.
All right. We're back attempting to hurl back liberalism with great force, and we have a reinforcement hurling back liberalism. We have Dr. Stephen Yates, of a philosophy professor at USC Upstate, and he teaches over at Greenville Tech. Welcome, Dr. Yates.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, I know you're a man of much information, and I actually have before me a book here with a green cover and a red cross on it that says Worldviews, Christian Theism versus Modern Materialism, and Stephen Yates, Ph.D., is the author. Could you tell us anything about it?
Well, the title is intended to convey the basic idea here that what we are seeing, have seen in Western civilization for a long time now, going back at least 200 years, is a clash between two worldviews. One of them, the term I'm using for it, is Christian theism, covers a certain amount of territory, and modern materialism. Now, modern American civilization originally had a Christian theist base that provided the foundation for constitutionally limited government. Modern materialism has come along and attempted to displace it and been largely successful, and we're seeing a lot of the cultural clashes we're seeing today are a result of that.
Could you give us a little maybe rundown of the table of contents here, and maybe just give us a quick rundown without giving away the whole book? Let us know a little more about the actual headings there. I've looked at them briefly. Book is not even published yet, is it? It's coming out shortly?
It should be out before the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
It should be on the printer's website within the next week to 2 weeks. That's where the printer's website will be, www.xlibris.com. But anyway, without giving away the whole plot...
This has a plot?
Every book has a plot.
Yeah, okay.
But the first chapter just tells what a worldview is in terms of a comprehensive system that includes human life. Chapter 2 describes the fundamental premises of Christian theism. Chapter 3 describes some objections to that have been raised within the Western philosophical tradition, and then how it's reasonable how to confront those objections. Chapter 4 discusses what materialism is and states what its premises are. Then we begin with the objections to those. And I outline four different objections to modern materialism. And along the way, I try to scuttle the idea that there is some kind of necessary connection between materialism as a worldview and scientific method. Modern science itself also fundamentally had a Christian base. It was rooted in fundamentally Christian assumptions about the world.
May I interrupt you here? We've been talking about evolution, creation, and so forth. Is that where that comes in there? In other words, you talked about a... I have to rewind here a minute. You talked about materialism, a connection between materialism and science. You say that that's not necessarily so. Did I quote you right there?
That's essentially correct. Now, it's interesting that you mention evolution and pull that in here, because while doing the original research for this book, I was able to pull a quotation out of a textbook on paleontology, which, paleontology, by the way, is a branch of geology concerned mainly with the study of fossils and the way the field has developed, trying to trace their evolutionary roots. But I dug out this quote that states specifically that one of the things that helped Darwin's theory gain the attention of aggressive young biologists was that...
What is an aggressive young biologist? Can you help me out on that?
Someone like Thomas Henry Huxley.
Okay. Could you tell us a little about him?
Huxley was essentially the leading biologist in England at the same time that Darwin was working on and published his Origin of Species. And the intellectual climate of the time was such that it was ready for a materialistic theory of the origins of life and of the origins of mankind. Now, I don't have the quote in front of me, so I can't get it exactly. But this is essentially what it says, that the intellectual climate in England at the time was ripe for a materialistic theory of the origins of life and of the origins of the human race. So they're talking about, I would emphasize, the intellectual climate rather than the evidence.
Hang on just a minute. We have a call? Yeah. Okay, well, we did have a call, but they have dropped off, but perhaps we can work that out where they can get in later. All right, back to the subject at hand. I interrupted you in your general review of what your book was all about there. Would you want to go on
just
explain a little more?
Well, we got most of the table contents in there.
Okay.
Well, I did leave out one thing, and I should say something because it's pretty important. Within Christian morality, it is the basic machinery, if that's the right word for it, for individuals controlling at least most of their base impulses. Now, I have long worked under the assumption that in every population, there's a minority within that population that gets obsessed by power. Why this is the case, I have no idea. That it is the case, I'm prepared to argue in great detail. The human species being a fallen race, this is just one of the ways that sin manifests itself throughout a population. It manifests itself in this minority that they tend to want to seize power.
Could we look over to Dr. Coben's book on public policy? The premise that government is basically evil and normally under the control of the evil one, the devil. Do you think we might be able to go down that road?
Well, I don't know that I would go so far as to say that government itself is fundamentally evil, because that kind of leads in the direction of sort of a theoretical anarchist or anarcho-capitalist kind of approach to things, which holds that the free market can solve every problem whatsoever, and I don't know if that's necessarily true. But on the other hand, having said that, government is certainly vulnerable to being captured by evil people who are obsessed with power.
The pigs of Animal Farm, so to speak.
Yes.
Yeah. The interesting thing about this, now, you and I kind of met a while back when I had written in the Times Examiner. Bob Dill let me put a book review I did of Dr. Coben's book, And a week later, I was surprised to see a reply that was about as long as my review, where you had responded. And one thing I had said in the review was that Dr. Coben has come up asked the question, maybe not the actual quote of the question, but he'd actually asked the question, is Romans 13, 1 through 7 the paradigm wherein we look at government and how the Christian should actually deal with that? Or are there other balancing texts of the Scriptures? It all has to do with what you were just saying about this this premise that you have, that there is a minority that tends to seize power, and we have Dr. Coben saying that government is normally under the power of the evil one. So it's something to be resisted, something to be tamed, something to be kept at bay.
Something to be tamed, certainly. But with Romans 13, I'm not an authority on Paul, but I have long read that passage in Scripture as working under the assumption that government, like every other human institution, should subordinate itself to God's holy will. And when it does meet this criteria, then our subordinating ourselves to it is legitimate and fine and right. But when government oversteps this boundary and tries to set itself up as, for lack of a better expression, a surrogate God, that's when it creates problems.
Yeah, one of the basic tenets of Dr. Van Til's philosophy was that all religions, apart from biblical religion, and now of course there's a little, you have the Baptists and you have the Reformers and you have the various people that have different thoughts on different texts, but generally speaking, biblical philosophy, a biblical world and life view, anything apart from that tends toward, as he puts it, dethroning God and setting man up in his place as what you're calling a surrogate God.
Well, yes, he's attacking humanism in very sophisticated theologians, scholarly language, but worldview, well, the ethical components of worldviews are, again, they're either theistic, which places God at the center and God's commands are your starting point, or they're humanistic, in which case human beings are at the center and their subjectivity.
Is there a line of demarcation there between what we would call humanism and theism, or are they butting heads like the mountain goats, or you follow what I'm talking about? In other words, if you go from biblical thought and humanistic thought, do they butt up next to one another? And that, is there any common ground in your thought process, intersection, or are they always clashing with one another? Did I give you a fair question there?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but they might have common ground in that both of them, well, this isn't always going to be the case for humanism, because postmodernist forms of humanism wouldn't concur on this point, but they both of them, in many of its other versions, they would both concur that there is something called truth, and Christian forms of science, at least as science originated, saw themselves as achieving truth within the overall framework of a Christian worldview. And as science became more and more materialistic, its purveyors, following perhaps the methodology of someone such as Auguste Comte, the mid-19th century French positivist, they still believed they were finding truth, but it was within the conceptual framework or worldview of a materialistic way of thinking about the fundamental nature of the universe. Okay. Now, I'm not sure if that answers your question or not, or if that's what you were asking me.
Well, I'm going in that general direction. We need to take a break right now, and we'll discuss these things a little further and bring in the CAFTA situation wherein you have all your information.
If you have a question or comment for the show, please dial 864-244-8177. That's 864-244-8177. You may also dial 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. Or you may email your question or comment to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. And remember, the show is live from 7:30 in the morning until 9 in the morning Eastern Time. If you're listening at any other time you're listening to a recording, calls will only be received between 7:30 and 9 in the morning Eastern Time.
You're listening to TRN, the Tyranny Response Network. It's roughage for your brain.
This is Dr. John Coben from Christian Worldview. You know, a lot of my listeners call and ask me about allodial land titles, covenant marriage, and other topics of importance to Christians who love liberty. Many of these things I've written about at the policyofliberty.net bookstore called Alertness Books. We invite you to visit the Alertness Books bookstore today and pick up the materials that will help you learn the truth and be free. Hi, this is Dr. John Coben. Is it okay for a Christian to become wealthy? Did you know that 8 out of 10 Americans will face retirement with little or no savings, even Americans who had good incomes? At Integrity Group, we are dedicated to providing personalized service, finding effective ways to protect and increase your hard-earned money. Integrity Group is an independent financial planning firm that offers a wide range of services. We specialize in finding creative, custom solutions to meet the needs of each individual. Do you have concerns about providing for your retirement? Do you want to ensure that catastrophes like disability or long-term care will not wipe out your savings? Do you need to have your assets protected from creditors? Do you want tax-advantaged growth of your savings? At Integrity Group, we recognize that time passes all too quickly. Sound financial planning is not something to be delayed. Our offices are located at 514 Pettigrew Street in downtown Greenville. Make an appointment with Integrity Group today at 864-244-6464. That's 864-244-6464.
As long as the state, the agency of coercion, stands over society offering to dispense economic privilege to those who pay it homage, conferring an advantage on some men at the expense of other men, the misuse of political power should be the first line of attack for the moralist. It is inevitable that political privilege will be used in this way if it is available and begging to be used. No people has ever resisted it who have been led into this temptation. Reverend Edmund Oppitz, in The Libertarian Theology of Freedom, page 84.
Welcome to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. Dr. Coben is an author, columnist, financial planner, and international lecturer. He holds a Ph.D. degree in public policy, M.A. degrees in economics and business economics, and is a graduate of Reformed Bible College. Dr. Coben is an outspoken critic of public schools, government regulation, the IRS, paper money, welfare, and abortion. An evangelical Christian and the father of 6 homeschooled children, Dr. Coben is applauded by listeners across America and around the world as a champion of liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Now let's join Dr. Coben with Christian Worldview.
All right, this is Greg Farrier, subbing for Dr. Coben, who's back in Peru till Monday. He'll be back here Monday. He's pushing back the frontiers of ignorance down in South America and Peru and Chile. And in the meantime, I have talked Dr. Professor Stephen Yates of USC Upstate and Greenville Tech, philosophy professor, to come in and have a chat with us about these things. We've already been talking about his book and worldviews and so forth. And one of the things that I do know that he's been chomping at the bit to be able to talk about has been the CAFTA, NAFTA-CAFTA, and the Federal Trade, Free Trade of America's situation. And What I wanted to do was kind of lead into this in how we talked about how people of a materialistic, humanistic mindset tend to want to control the rest of the masses. Could we push the reverse button there and talk about control of the where you were talking about before, the control of the minority over the majority, and lead this into what CAFTA is all about in our national sovereignty and what it's going to do to our industry and public life, social life? Did I give you a mouthful there?
Yeah, that's a big area.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best place to begin is possibly just with that red flag phrase, the New World Order.
Okay.
Which the first George Bush used publicly, although he certainly didn't invent the phrase. In fact, the phrase the New World Order goes back decades, if not actually centuries. The British author and Fabian socialist H.G. Wells wrote a couple of books. In fact, one of them was called The Open Conspiracy.
Can you give us a date for those books, or around what time they were?
Around 1920s, 1930s. I don't have the exact years, but that's in the ballpark. One was called The Open Conspiracy, and the other one was actually called The New World Order. And he also wrote things with titles like The Shape of Things to Come. Now, most people think of H.G. Wells, they associate him with the popular science fiction novels like, well, they made a movie out of it starring Tom Cruise, War of the Worlds, and we think of that, but Wells was basically a socialist. He was a member of the British Fabian Society, and that's just one of the many groups that have developed over the centuries that were obsessed with this notion of, it's called transforming civilization or transforming society. So watch for that word transforming. You see it a lot these days. They're talking about instituting a fundamentally new world order, lowercase letters if you want.
All right. Now, when people hear things like that, people like Limbaugh and Hannity and others, they say, oh, you're a conspiracy nut. To me, conspiracy means breathing together, right? Are you somebody who believes in this worldwide conspiracy, or are they little conspiracies here and there, or a bunch of big ones? Can you give us a perspective on that? Give us a little focus on. As I said, you said that there were groups, right? And
right.
If they're groups, they're breathing together, they're conspiring, as opposed to, you know, the people that Limbaugh and other so-called conservatives, you know, they just throw the flag up and say, oh, you're a conspiracy nut, and, you know, turn you off. Can you give us a little perspective on that? I know you can.
Well, it's a difficult question to begin with, but
all my difficult questions.
You approach this empirically, just really, it's just like any other empirical historical inquiry. And I think the result that you get if you approach this thing honestly and with an open mind is that you do see that there are a number of fairly substantial groups. Some of them begin with famous bloodlines. It's probably a good place to begin. Like in Europe, it's the Rothschild family, which had established a banking empire by the late 1700s. And did the Rothschilds really engage in activities which bent European history in a new direction? I think the answer to that question would be yes. And in the United States, the name that comes to mind first is Rockefeller. John D. Rockefeller Sr. established an empire in oil, but he did receive some assistance, at least at the very beginning, through Rothschild money. So there you are. Mm-hmm. You do have these famous bloodlines. And you also have organizations. I mentioned the Fabian Society and what the relationship is between the Fabians and the Rothschilds, if there is one, is something I'm still working on. I don't have the final answers.
Do you have any dates for the Rothschilds when all that began to rise?
Well, the mid to late 1700s is when the Rothschilds were getting started. The first Rothschild was, if I'm pronouncing his name right, Mayor Amschel Rothschild, who, and his most famous remark goes something like, "Give me control of the finances of a country, and I care not who makes its laws," which tells you something interesting right there.
That's a rather chilling quote.
Yes, and
We're getting a proper date here.
1743, I believe, is the founding date for... It's either the date that Rothschild was born or the date that he founded his company. I'm not sure which one, without really checking my notes.
Yeah, well,
I don't have all of this in my head.
I'm just looking in terms of going back to what era, you know, the 1800s, whatever it might be, just to give us an idea of a little bit of a timeline when these things began to happen.
Well, anyway, in the late 1700s, the senior Rothschild had five sons, and each of these sons founded a bank in a different city, in a different European nation, and by virtue of this, the House of Rothschild became the first international investment banking establishment. They worked very closely together. They were very conscious of what they were doing. They began loaning money to governments because they had already discovered that if they could loan money with interest, the fractional reserve banking system, they could and then extend those loans, attaching conditions to those extensions, they could come to control governments.
I've used that term fractional on people in conversation, and people kind of give you a blank look. Can you elaborate on that just a little bit?
It's very difficult to define clearly. It's very difficult to understand, but it involves extending a loan and attaching interest to that loan given a finite amount of currency that exists in the society at a given time. The loan, in fact, the total number of loans, I should say, can never be repaid because that currency doesn't exist. So, in fact, the debt is perpetual.
Perpetual in that you're fractional in that you're dividing it and dividing it and dividing it until finally it becomes unpayable, so to speak.
Yes,
and useful to a few, and it becomes useless to the many, you might say.
And it's a way of basically stealing out of the pockets of the many. Now, there was a book, it was originally published in 1899, and I don't have the author's name with me, but the title of the book is The Coming Battle, and it's available through the newswithviews.com website. And that book is a history of the struggle to keep the investment bankers at bay throughout the late 1700s and 1800s in this century. Now, at one point, Andrew Jackson, who became president right at the late 1820s or 1830s, right around in there, actually told a group of investment bankers, "You are a den of vipers."
Mm. Yeah, like old Hickory.
"I will rout you out."
Yeah, typical of old Hickory.
But what these people wanted to do was establish a central bank in the United States. And there was, at that time anyway, enormous resistance to the idea of central banking because, based on the experience in Europe, our founders didn't trust it. In fact, Thomas Jefferson gave a very stern warning against allowing investment bankers to control.
Okay, let's take this up. It's time for a break, and we'll be back shortly.
I can look up that quote.
If you have a question or comment for the show, please dial 864-244-8177. That's 864-244-8177. You may also dial 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. Or you may email your question or comment to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. And remember, the show is live from 7:30 in the morning until 9 in the morning Eastern Time. If you're listening at any other time you're listening to a recording, calls will only be received between 7:30 and 9 in the morning Eastern Time. You're listening to homeschooler-friendly TRN, the Tyranny Response Network.
The Patriot Network is a national federation of local clubs devoted to bringing relief to the oppressed American taxpayer. It is based right here in the South Carolina Upcountry and chaired by Dr. John Coben's associate, legendary freedom warrior Robert Clarkson. Visit our website at patriotnetwork.info for full contact information, meeting times, and locations around the South and beyond. That's Patriot Network, one word, .info. There you can also sample many action reports, current and past issues of our newsletter, and mainstream news features about IRS rot, corruption, and incompetence. Find out what our decades-old organization may be able to do to put a stop to your IRS problems. PatriotNetwork.info commends Dr. John Coben on the founding of the Tyranny Response Network and his unique Christian worldview show, heard weekday mornings right here on TRN.
Are you interested in knowing about the faith and legacies of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson? Check out Warriors of Honor. It's a new DVD produced by New Liberty Videos. You can get a copy of this video by emailing the Tyranny Response Network production staff at production@policyofliberty.net. That's production@policyofliberty.net. It's only $20, and it's well worth it. Take it from me, Dr. John Coben. I've seen this video, Warriors of Honor. It is just outstanding in producing something of value for those who love liberty, who hold to the Christian perspective, and want to be encouraged about our past. Finally, a documentary that is willing to speak plainly about the Christian faith of Jackson and Lee. It is a beautiful and accurate account of two great Southern leaders and a war that forever changed our country. Steve Wilkins.
There is a place for government in the affairs of men, and our Declaration of Independence tells us precisely what that is. The role of government is to protect individuals in their God-given individual rights. Freedom is the natural birthright of man, but all that government can do in behalf of freedom is to let the individual alone, and it should secure him his rights by making others let him alone. Reverend Edmund Oppitz, in The Libertarian Theology of Freedom, page 142.
Liberalism is not to be tossed lightly aside, but to be hurled with great force.
All right, we're back. This is Greg Farrier with Dr. Stephen Yates. We're having a discussion of a little bit of the history of federal banking and central banking. Is there not something in the Constitution that says that Congress is are the ones that are supposed to coin money?
Exactly. The Constitution says this explicitly, that it is the job of Congress to coin money and regulate the value thereof.
All right. Now, where is the Federal Reserve come in on all this?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I'm full of good questions, a few confusing and general ones, but I thought that was a pretty good one there. Where does the Federal Reserve come in? I heard it said that it's no more federal than Federal Express.
Well, it's not part of the government. It's a private corporation. Well, more specifically, it's essentially a cartel of private banks, the very sort of thing that, as I mentioned earlier, Thomas Jefferson warned against. Now, I found a specific quote from Jefferson. Now, Jefferson had been to Europe. He had observed the French Revolution and other events firsthand. So I think we can cite him as a significant authority who knew what he was talking about. Here's the quote, word for word: "If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the government, to whom it properly belongs. So the claim that central banking is dangerous both to liberty and ultimately to free enterprise itself couldn't have been said more clearly.
Yeah, how about when you hear about these private banks that deal in gold and silver and precious metals and so forth, are they legitimate too? During the colonial times, you had French money circulating. I think you even had the Spanish money circulating, like up from Mexico and so forth. And of course, you had the British crowns, the British plus continental dollars. Where do they come in? Do you know?
Well, if the first thing to note there is that you really have a variety of different systems going on there. You have genuine competition. No one is really being forced necessarily to use a specific currency. If my grasp of the situation is right, so you don't really have a central banking system there. In fact, the idea of currency being backed by something, whether it's gold or whether it's silver, to keep the currency stable, where it has objective backing. So that's a much more acceptable situation. What Jefferson was warning about, as I understand him, was this idea of a cartel of central banks.
Okay, now let me run this one past you. I said that there was French money circulating in the colonies. There was Spanish, English, and I guess maybe some private, all kinds of probably German money circulating in the colonies. Now, I assume that's all private, free market. I can see a danger there in that if the Rothschilds put their money in there and began to overwhelm all the others, there's a central bank right there. So perhaps Jefferson had the idea of Congress coining this money to keep it out of the hands of somebody like the Rothschilds or a central banker from coming in and overwhelming the banking market. I know that was theoretical, but,
Certainly he was familiar with the Rothschild manipulation, so it's certainly reasonable to think that that's what he might have had in mind.
Okay. Where were we talking in terms of central banks and where this leads to population control, government control, and so forth?
Well, if you've got a group that can control a country's finances, they can fundamentally control the economy
and
micromanage it kind of from a central point. Now, the micromanaging may not be done particularly well. In fact, Austrian economists, someone such as Ludwig von Mises, for example, would say that it can't be done effectively at all. That's another conversation for another time. The point is, it did develop.
Yeah. Well, so when Mr. Greenspan gets out before Congress and he tells you, well, inflation is this, and we're going to have to raise the interest rates, and the economy is just humming right along, right in front of our noses, he's telling you what he wants you to know about how they're micromanaging the economy.
Yeah, and it's useful to note that FDR started the train, that the runaway train, you might say, of taking us off the gold standard, and then Richard Nixon finished the job in 1971, and the country's debt, which includes the national debt, corporate debt, consumer debt, has been building ever since. Now, I don't know that... I think the national debt is... Well, it's approaching $8 billion. I don't have an exact figure on that, but it's climbing and fast. I don't know if anybody knows for sure the total indebtedness mm-hmm. of the country, including all of those other figures.
Now, in a fractional economy, that is really just a lot of air, is it not?
Well,
it's on a piece of paper that makes people think that, this is real money. But then again, on the other hand, it is... is it just air that can just vanish away if somebody just wiped it all out, or is it something that can actually, when the debt comes home, when the debt is called up, is that put somebody under somebody else's control?
Well, the term I like to use sometimes is funny money, which is mm-hmm. fiat currency, which is just unbacked currency that the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury Department working together, they pump into the economy, and of course this is what went on in the 90s, and that's how come the stock market absolutely exploded during the late 90s. It was all this funny money, this fiat currency, and the entire country went on a massive spending spree. But essentially, it's difficult to explain. He said, and there's a sense in which it is all hot air,
mm-hmm. yeah.
because the prosperity is not real. But the debt, there's a sense in which it is real, and that it will have to be repaid eventually. It's borrowed against the future.
All right, now we're being handed a note here. Have you got the?
The note says $8 trillion. I presume that refers to where our national debt is rapidly approaching.
Yep, that's it. Trillions as opposed to billions.
Trillions as opposed to billions. That's a very big number.
Yes, extremely big number. Thank you, Mr. Broadcast Engineer, for looking that up for us. That is current information, by the way, for those of you keeping track of all this. Where were we on this? As far as the national debt, what does that actually do? What does it actually harm? Now, we all say, yeah, I don't want to be in debt because the borrower is servant to the lender. But is the lender in this case, who is the lender in this case? And who is the borrower? I'm not talking, do I need to talk in ultimate terms or I need to talk in practical terms?
Both.
Okay. Well, let's go. We got a few minutes here. Is it a fair question?
Well, yes and no. Yes, it's a fair question. No, I am on the process of researching a lot of these things myself, and so I don't have the ultimate answers to everything. The lenders, though, is the central banking cartel, the investment bankers, the borrowers, everybody else, mm-hmm. in the broad sense of the term.
In other words, the United States. All right. Now, what happens if this debt, can this debt be called?
Well, if the debt were called, the economy would. I'm not sure of the exact mechanics of the thing, but there would be sudden. I think there would be a sudden deflationary downward spiral and currency collapse. It would be a nightmare.
Yeah, but there are people that are doing a balancing act out there at the Federal Reserve, just.
Oh, they don't want this to happen. Trust mm-hmm. me. The power elites, the globalists, mm-hmm. the New World Order, whatever you want to call them, it's not as if they want this to happen. If they did, it would be an end to their little empire.
Okay. Well, let's take all this up in another few minutes. We got a break.
If you have a question or comment for the show, please dial 864-244-8177. That's 864-244-8177. You may also dial 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. Or you may email your question or comment to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. And remember, the show is live from 7:30 in the morning until 9 in the morning Eastern Time. If you're listening at any other time you're listening to a recording, calls will only be received between 7:30 and 9 in the morning Eastern Time.
You're listening to TRN, the Tyranny Response Network. It's roughage for your brain.
Hi, this is Dr. John Coben. Is it okay for a Christian to become wealthy? Did you know that 8 out of 10 Americans will face retirement with little or no savings, even Americans who had good incomes? At Integrity Group, we are dedicated to providing personalized service, finding effective ways to protect and increase your hard-earned money. Integrity Group is an independent financial planning firm that offers a wide range of services. We specialize in finding creative, custom solutions to meet the needs of each individual. Do you have concerns about providing for your retirement? Do you want to ensure that catastrophes like disability or long-term care will not wipe out your savings? Do you need to have your assets protected from creditors? Do you want tax-advantaged growth of your savings? At Integrity Group, we recognize that time passes all too quickly. Sound financial planning is not something to be delayed. Our offices are located at 514 Pettigrew Street in downtown Greenville. Make an appointment with Integrity Group today at 864-244-6464. That's 864-244-6464.
As long as the state, the agency of coercion, stands over society offering to dispense economic privilege to those who pay it homage, conferring an advantage on some men at the expense of other men, the misuse of political power should be the first line of attack for the moralist. It is inevitable that political privilege will be used in this way if it is available and begging to be used. No people has ever resisted it who have been led into this temptation. Reverend Edmund Oppitz, in The Libertarian Theology of Freedom, page 84.
The Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments of the American Constitution. Amendment 1. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedoms of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Amendment 2. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. Amendment 3. No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Amendment 4. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Amendment 5. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject to the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Amendment 6. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. Amendment 7. In suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Amendment 8. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Amendment 9. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Amendment 10. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people.
Welcome to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. Dr. Coben is an author, columnist, financial planner, and international lecturer. He holds a Ph.D. degree in public policy, M.A. degrees in economics and business economics, and is a graduate of Reformed Bible College. Dr. Coben is an outspoken critic of public schools, government regulation, the IRS, paper money, welfare, and abortion. An evangelical Christian and the father of six homeschooled children, Dr. Coben is applauded by listeners across America and around the world as a champion of liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Now let's join Dr. Coben with Christian Worldview.
All right, this is Greg Farrier substituting for John Coben, who's down in South America, pushing back, as I've said before, the frontiers of ignorance. With us, we have Dr. Stephen Yates, a professor at USC Upstate, and he's also a professor over there at Greenville Tech. We've been talking about central banking, but in order to get the good doctor is well-versed and anxious to talk about is CAFTA. So we're going to take this up to the end of the show. And all right, tell me what it's all about.
CAFTA, let me see. Where do I begin?
Well, the name.
Central American Free Trade Agreement.
Okay.
And unfortunately, it's not really a free trade agreement. It's a managed trade agreement. And you could say that CAFTA is the long-term descendant of the same people that basically gave us the central banking or investment banking system that we were talking about earlier.
I knew there was a transition there. Yeah.
You are still talking about a highly centralized, micromanaged kind of system with really the same mindset. Now, it's useful to note initially, before going any further, that originally there was no CAFTA. That originally, a group of very powerful and immensely wealthy people, and including one-time President George Bush, the first one, and Bill Clinton, met in Miami, Florida, for the first Summit of the Americas. This was in 1994. They dreamed up this idea of a free trade area of the Americas, the FTAA, I'll be calling it. The FTAA had its goal as creating a single hemispheric free trade zone. It was the term they were using at the time. They loved this term free trade, which I'll talk about more later if I don't jog my memory, so I get back to it. But in any regard, their model was the kind of economic integration that was already in process over in Europe, and which has given us the European Union, which is a fundamentally quasi-socialist empire over there in Europe. European nations they've given up their currency and they're losing their sovereignty. So this notion was definitely a threat to U.S. independence, U.S. sovereignty, and what little is left of our constitutional republic. I think one of the things that the elites didn't count on was the rapid development of the internet and the World Wide Web and the late 90s. The best thing you can say about the late 90s is that it gave us that. So through email, grassroots efforts came out of the increasing amount of knowledge about the FTAA. It was no longer possible to control information.
So all right, now you were going from CAFTA to free trade of the Americas. Did I miss something there?
No, not really, because the free trade area of the Americas came first.
Okay.
And just building up to, the FTAA started to encounter opposition at the grassroots level. So right around the start of, I believe it was 2003, the present George Bush and some of the people that he was working with conceived of the idea of an intermediary, an intermediate stage, you might say. CAFTA came out of that. So that's what I mean when I say, that's what I said earlier, that originally there was no CAFTA. The Central American Free Trade Agreement just tries to the economic integration of just six nations, six Central American nations: El Salvador, Dominican Republic, Honduras, Guatemala, See, I missed a couple of them there. Costa Rica,
mm-hmm.
And so on.
Okay, at least we get the flavor of where all that is.
And CAFTA was presented as a small agreement. In fact, our representative in the 4th District here, Bob Inglis, has said that repeatedly, that this is really just a small agreement. And the answer is, well, if it was really that small and insignificant of an agreement, then why the enormous amount of deal cutting and arm twisting and everything else that was going on behind the scenes?
At taxpayers' expense.
At taxpayers' expense, in order to get this thing through Congress. It passed the Senate by the slimmest margin that a trade accord had ever passed in the Senate. And then when it got to the House, well, CAFTA passed in the House by a vote of 217 to 215, as many of us know. Narrowest passage.
Narrowest of margins.
In fact, one vote had been different. Two votes had been different. It would have gone down in flames. So, actually, we did fairly well. I have been involved in a nationwide organization, the Citizens Committee to Stop the FTAA, which we turned our attention to CAFTA, of course, when it became the front burner issue. But when you consider that the pro-CAFTA forces were backed with some very deep pockets, those of us who were opposed to CAFTA were doing it on our own time, with no pay, working around our work-a-day real jobs, so to speak. We didn't do half badly. And one of the things we need to do now is to draw attention to all the behind-the-scenes manipulations. What really went on that night that CAFTA passed? Well, one of the things that went on was that they extended a 15-minute vote. It was supposed to be cut off after 15 minutes, in other words. It extended to over an hour because the pro-CAFTA side didn't have the votes. It would have gone down in flames if they'd played by their own rules. So they didn't play by the rules.
Another 45 minutes to twist their arm, so to speak.
Another 45 minutes of arm twisting and deal cutting, and including people who voted for CAFTA that had told their constituencies that they were going to vote against it. They voted for it anyway.
Okay, now let me run this one past you, unless I'm interrupting your thought process here. When I hear talk radio, they go out and they talk about how NAFTA's been good for the country. It is, the factories are churning out all kinds of material, and the economy's up on the rise. All because, maybe not all because of, but NAFTA, it's done well. Now CAFTA's just another addition to that, and you're holding up something in front of me that I'm going to let you comment on. It's a graph. Because I know I asked you in show prep last night, I asked you about this and it got you a little ticked off. So I'm asking you this for the benefit of those in our radio audience, and basically I'm just giving you a leading question here. NAFTA, CAFTA,
SHAFTA. SHAFTA.
Yeah, that sort of
cartoon
thing.
Floating around on the web.
Yeah, the neocon talk show hosts out there are saying it, they've all been good for, or NAFTA's been good for us, CAFTA's going to be good for us. They don't say much about the Free Trade of Americas thing. Your comments, please, sir.
Well, I've calmed down since last night.
Oh, you have? All right. Now you ought to be more sober and ready to give us a good explanation, right?
One thing to note is that we had a trade surplus with Mexico prior to NAFTA. So it was some deficits going way back into the 80s, but they had become surpluses. Then NAFTA gets passed, goes into effect January of 1994. NAFTA was passed in 1993, of course. Goes into effect in 1994, and the surplus again becomes a deficit and does so almost overnight. And we have literally thousands of factories closing and going to Mexico. And naturally, a lot of those communities, their whole economic life of that community was based around the local textile mills, especially here in the Carolinas.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those other, a lot of other local businesses. We're talking about restaurants. We're talking about really just about anything that thrive on and work under the assumption that the people who live there, who work in those textile mills, have money to spend in those places. So when the mill closes, all of those other places close too. You just have ripple effects, and entire communities became ghost towns almost overnight. So I'm not saying that NAFTA was the only bad thing that happened to the economy right around that same time, but really I don't know how someone can really claim to be a conservative who believes in free enterprise, etc., etc., and say that NAFTA was good for the economy. It wasn't really a free trade agreement.
What was it?
I would call it a micromanaged trade agreement. The text of NAFTA runs to tens of thousands of pages. Why do you need tens of thousands of pages to have a free trade agreement? Why not? I think the economist Walter Williams says something like this. Just have a statement to the effect that there will be no barriers, tariffs, or otherwise, or no governmental interference between trade between Americans and Mexicans.
So
there's
not
your free trade agreement.
It's not really free trade. It's managed trade.
It's managed trade.
You know what you're referring to. I remember Dr. Coben was with us, and of course he was in one of Dr. Williams' classes, and he said Dr. Williams came into the class with a big fat copy of the. It must have been an abbreviated copy, but it would fill your hand in paperwork, and he said that. He doesn't even have to read it to know that it's all regulation. He says if it was really a free trade document, it would be one page long saying there will be free trade between all these countries involved.
Yeah, it's about a policy of non-interference. What is free trade anyway? I've started writing an article on this. It'll maybe my next NewsWithViews.com piece if I can ever get around to getting it finished. But it's going to raise the question, what is free trade anyway? What's a question we have to ask before we decide whether it's good or whether it's bad. For anything, we need some kind of a clear notion of what it is. If I have something, or something that I've produced, or a service that I can offer, and I offer it, you are interested in it, in purchasing it from me, or purchasing my service, so we come to a voluntary agreement on price and other terms. There's no real reason why anybody else needs to get involved. Nobody else is being harmed by it in any way. So we trade. That's free trade.
Okay,
it goes on between individuals agreeing voluntarily on a value for value exchange.
I know something about what's in your book. I want the information that's in your book. I give you some money of some sort. You give me the book, and away we go.
No. Exactly.
Okay. Nobody's hurt. Nobody is bothered by that. Okay.
Exactly.
Regulations may come in. Where would a legitimate regulation come in on something where a regulation to begin with would be somebody who would be an arbiter between us, where I maybe didn't trust you, or you didn't trust me.
Well, we do have these unfortunate occurrences where, how do you say it? Well, we don't want businesses producing products that kill their customers.
Mm-hmm.
So,
or with which they're not satisfied.
Or you don't want fraud.
Right.
To another example. So to the extent that people behave irresponsibly, the regulation is going to creep into the picture.
Yeah, when a nation is not behaving itself, where it is immoral in this regard, God tends to send bureaucrats, doesn't he?
Bureaucrats could be God's punishment visited mm-hmm. on the irresponsible business person.
Yeah, well, a punishment or a chastisement or something that wherein, in other words, at one time you could have done it for just the free trade, if agreement between two people, but yep. When your handshake is no good anymore, somebody's got to come in and draw up a document to call the cheater on what he's done.
Correct. Well, ideally, civilization works under the assumption that its citizens can trust one another, at least most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And if that trust begins to dissolve, then you've got problems.
All right, now that brings up another thought in my mind here. How much, if we have to have all these papers and all these regulations, how much do we trust Costa Rica, Guatemala, Canada, the United States, Mexico? Do you follow my train of thought on that?
Yeah. One thing, though, this sort of activity, the regulation, the growth of bureaucracy, it begins to snowball. It begins to go on beyond any sort of legitimate control of irresponsibility and takes on a life of its own. Bureaucracy has to justify itself. If it actually solves the problems it was created to solve, then it loses its reason for being. It's raison d'être, I guess is the right French phrase.
Mm-hmm.
So they never solve the problems. The problems just magnify and continue to get worse. Bureaucracy continues to expand. It takes on a life of its own, and the end result is these so-called free trade accords that are tens of thousands of pages long. I think CAFTA is several thousand pages. I don't have an exact figure there, but you can, anyone who wants to, it's online. It's on at www.ustr.gov.
And you have all kinds of lawyers and bureaucrats that are going to have to go through all this in order to interpret these types of things. I mean, who's even going to pay attention to such a huge thing? Is it just something that a bureaucrat or an international banker or some wealthy, powerful individual is just going to use to control trade to their benefit?
Well, bureaucrats will use, and others too, will use them to their advantage when they can. As for the people who have to interpret these rules, they have my sympathy.
Yeah, well, that kind of stuff just goes on and on. Surely in there's one that contradicts another. You know,
People have asked folks like Bob Inglis, did you actually read the document? Well, it's pretty clear that he didn't. But on the other hand, I have read parts of it, and I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy.
Yeah, well, why is it there? Who are the people there that put this to these people?
Well, some of it was cribbed from NAFTA. Some of it was cribbed from WTO sources. It wasn't just written out of whole cloth from scratch.
Yeah,
you can find there's a section on government procurements in Chapter 9 of CAFTA, for example. If you go back and look at the Doha Accords that involved in the creation of the World Trade Organization, you'll see the same stuff, almost word for word.
Yeah. We're running out of time here right now. What the question that has always been burning around in my mind about it, who did it? Who wants it? And so forth. Who put the money or the effort into putting this thing up? Who benefits from it?
In a broad sense, the group I call either the super elite or the globalists, or they use the term C. Wright Mills used, the power elite. There is a group of people who want power. And they want to establish a world government. That's their long-term goal. And the flip side of that goal, of course, is to establish, or rather socially engineer, I should say, a population that will, really populations, since this is going on all over the Western world, that will accept living under a world government. Now, if I can find the quote straight out of the horse's mouth, David Rockefeller himself, for more than a century, I am quoting him now, ideological extremists at either end of the political spectrum have attacked the Rockefeller family for the inordinate influence they believe we wield over American political and economic institutions. Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists, and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I am proud of it. That's David Rockefeller Sr., his book Memoirs, published in 2002. That's in a chapter entitled Proud Internationalist. So when Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity say that nothing is going on here, that this is all paranoid delusion, or however it is they say it, they're simply ignoring what the globalists have said with their own words.
Well, that is a rather chilling situation. We'd like to thank you for coming in here this morning, and we'll be playing this on the loop during the day. Real informative. Please come back and fill us all in, perhaps when on the regular times when Dr. Coben's here, and you can have a real informative chat about these things. Thanks so much for coming in.
I appreciate the invite.
All right. This is Greg closing out the show right now. Come back and listen to us. Listen to us on the loop if you can at 97.7. On your computer, and we'll get in here, Lord willing, 7:30 tomorrow till 9. One more day of me substituting for Dr. John Coben in on TRN.
Thank you for joining us today on Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. We hope you will be with us tomorrow morning at 7:30 right here at the Tyranny Response Network for Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. Have you been knocked hard in the school of